The real story isn't half as pretty as the one you've heard. The real story is, the miller's daughter with her long golden hair wants to catch a lord, a prince, a rich man's son. So she goes to the moneylender and borrows for a ring and a necklace and decks herself out for the festival. And she's beautiful enough. So the lord, the prince, the rich man's son notices her and dances with her and tumbles her in a quiet hayloft when the dancing is over. And afterwards he goes home and marries the rich woman his family has picked out for him. Then the miller's despoiled daughter tells everyone that the moneylender's in league with the devil. And the village runs him out, or maybe even stones him. So at least she gets to keep the jewels for a dowry. And the blacksmith marries her before that firstborn child comes along a little early. Because that's what the story's really about. Getting out of paying your debts. That's not how they tell it, but I knew. My father was a moneylender, you see. He wasn't very good at it. If someone didn't pay him back on time, he never so much as mentioned it to them. Only if our cupboards were really bare, or our shoes were falling off our feet, and my mother spoke quietly with him after I was in bed. Then he'd go, unhappy, and knock on a few doors and make it sound like an apology when he asked for some of what they owed. And if there was money in the house and someone asked to borrow, he hated to say no, even if we really didn't have enough ourselves. So all his money, most of which had been my mother's money, her dowry, stayed in other people's houses. And everyone else liked it that way, even though they knew they ought to be ashamed of themselves. So they told the story often, even or especially when I could hear it. My mother's father was a moneylender too, but he was a very good one. He lived in Visnia, 40 miles away by the pitted old trading road that dragged from village to village like a string full of small, dirty knots. Mama often took me on visits, when she could afford a few pennies to pay someone to let us ride along at the back of a peddler's cart or a sledge. 5 or 6 changes along the way. Sometimes we caught glimpses of the other road through the trees, the one that belonged to the Starik, gleaming like the top of the river in winter when the snow had blown clear. "Don't look, Miriam," my mother would tell me, but I always kept watching it out of the corner of my eye, hoping to keep it near, because it meant a quicker journey. Whoever was driving the cart would slap the horses and hurry them up until it vanished again. One time, we heard the hooves behind us as they came off their road, a sound like ice cracking, and the driver beat the horses quick to get the cart behind a tree. And we all huddled there in the well of the wagon among the sacks, my mother's arm wrapped around my head, holding it down so I couldn't be tempted to take a look. They rode past us and did not stop. It was a poor peddler's cart covered in dull tin pots, and Starik knights only ever came riding for gold. The hooves went jangling past, and a knife wind blew over us. So when I sat up, the end of my thin braid was frosted white, and all of my mother's sleeve where it wrapped around me and our backs. But the frost faded, and as soon as it was gone, the peddler said to my mother, "Well, that's enough of a rest, isn't it?" As if he didn't remember why we had stopped. "Yes," my mother said, nodding, as if she didn't remember either. And he got back up onto the driver's seat and clucked to the horses and set us going again. I was young enough to remember it afterwards a little, and not old enough to care about the Starik as much as about the ordinary cold biting through my clothes and my pinched stomach. I didn't want to say anything that might make the cart stop again, impatient to get to the city and my grandfather's house. My grandmother would always have a new dress for me, plain and dull brown but warm and well made, and each winter a pair of new leather shoes that didn't pinch my feet and weren't patched and cracked around the edges. She would feed me to bursting 3 times every day, and the last night before we left she would always make cheesecake, her cheesecake, which was baked golden on the outside and thick and white and crumbly inside, and tasted just a little bit of apples and she would make decorations with sweet golden raisins on the top. After I had slowly and lingeringly eaten every last bite of a slice wider than the palm of my hand, they would put me to bed upstairs, in the big cozy bedroom where my mother and her sisters had slept as girls, in the same narrow wooden bed carved with doves. My mother would sit next to her mother by the fireplace and put her head on her shoulder. They wouldn't speak. But when I was a little older and didn't fall asleep right away, I would see in the firelight glow that both of them had a little wet track of tears down their faces. We could have stayed. There was room in my grandfather's house and welcome for us. But we always went home because we loved my father. He was terrible with money. But he was endlessly warm and gentle, and he tried to make up for his failings. He spent nearly all of every day out in the cold woods hunting for food and firewood, and when he was indoors, there was nothing he wouldn't do to help my mother. No talk of woman's work in my house. And when we did go hungry, he went hungriest and snuck food from his plate to ours. When he sat by the fire in the evenings, his hands were always working, whittling some new little toy for me or something for my mother, a decoration on a chair or a wooden spoon.